playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Over a fortnight on from Vicky Phelan going public, there were even more harrowing stories this week as the fallout from the cervical check scandal continued to play out in real time. Last week, Emma Vicfahuna was informed she was one of the women who'd been wrongly told that her smear test was clear. On Wednesday, Emma found out that she's dying from cervical cancer. She's only 37 and the mother of five children. Her youngest, Donnacha, is only two. She spoke with Audrey Carville on Thursday's Morning Ireland.
I learned this week that I'm dying and that the cancer is, it's covered my lungs and everything. So I have a test on Friday to see exactly how long I've left.
And who told you this devastating news?
My GP.
And Emma, did you think you'd be clear? Did you hope you'd be clear?
I hoped I'd be clear, but I had a feeling that I was. I had a feeling I had cancer again because I'd had it before, but I didn't think it would be terminal.
Have you told your children?
I have, yeah.
And how are they? You have a very young family.
Devastated. Just crying thinking about it. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to do because as a mother, it's my job to protect them and to keep the bad news away from them. And we had such a good day on the confirmation. Like, I was, my results were ready on Tuesday, but I didn't want to get them because it was their confirmation. And then I had to collect them from school early and tell them that I'm dying. And it's just, it's a horrible thing to witness, to be honest. There's so much pain in that.
Is there any treatment, anything left that you can do?
And they know more and they get the results on Friday. But all the doctors, like, in, you know, the gynecologist, the oncologist, my GP, I've such a fabulous team that I'm in good care in that sense, you know. So if there's anything available, they'll find it.
And Emma, you had just found out that you had a smear test in 2013, which you thought was normal, but it wasn't. But you never knew that.
No. So the 2013 smear said that I was healthy when I wasn't. And because of that, then I actually developed cancer. Now I'm dying. And if the smear test was right, and I was told this by my gynecologist, who is over three hospitals, so he knows his stuff. This guy is amazing. And he told me himself that if my smear test was right in 2013, I wouldn't be where I am today. And this is what makes it so heartbreaking. I'm dying when I don't need to die. And my children are going to be without me. And I'm going to be without them. And I try to do everything right by, you know, breastfeeding and being a full-time mum and sacrificing, you know, my own life for them. I didn't see it as a sacrifice. And now I'm going to miss out. And I don't even know if my little baby's going to remember me. And what just makes this whole situation so sick is that the government aren't doing anything about it. And when it first broke out, I was like, okay, well, the head of the HSE is surely going to do something. And he didn't. And then I looked to Simon Harris. I was thinking, well, surely the Minister for Health is going to step in and do something. That's how we give these people powers. And he do anything. So then I was like, surely the Taoiseach is going to do something. And he just seems to be sticking up for them. And they're all hiding there in the dough and they don't see what I see. And, like, there's women that are dead and there doesn't just any women. They're like people's daughters and their mammies and all the children are in so much pain. And I just, my stance on it is, I think the only person that can do something now is the president. And I never actually thought I'd say something like that in the country in 2018 in Ireland. Because the government needs to go. They're not actually, and I'm not being insulting, it's genuine, they're not actually capable of minding us. And that is their job, to make sure that we're okay. I'm dying and I didn't even need to die. And I'm only 37. And like last night I was in bed and I was having this really bad dream. I dreamt that I was dying last night and I wasn't ready because I hadn't said goodbye to my children. And in my dream I was trying to ring 999 but I couldn't like pick up the phone. So in my dream I had gone into Natasha. She sits across to London. And I was trying to wake her up so that I could say goodbye to her because I hadn't said goodbye. And then I woke up and I was like, God, thank God I haven't died yet because I want to say goodbye to them. And this isn't fair. And no amount of money can replace this. I know, like, which of my children, like, put her in, which of them have need time out when they're getting tired and all the fun stuff we do together, like, we have such good fun, the six of us. And I moved all the way down here to Ballydavid. But it's such a fantastic place because all my children are boys. And it's really like Enid Blyton down here. They go climbing on the rocks and they go camping in the field. And they're so safe and they build sandcastles. And that's all been taken away from them. And yesterday I just sit down with the teachers and I was like, what are we going to do? Do you understand what I mean?
I do. I mean, there's nothing I can say. I'm so, so sorry. I'm so, so sorry.
It seemed the whole country was reeling after Emma Vicfahuna's heart-stopping testimony, and the political temperature ratcheted up later with these exchanges at the Public Accounts Committee between Fianna Fáil TD Mark McSharry and HSE Chief Tony O'Brien.
Mrs. Vicfahuna on the radio this morning has not time to wait. She said she's too angry to worry about dying. And we're in here kicking a football around about, let's have an investigation, let's see what happened. Where is the accountability?
Why don't we both wait until the outcome of the expert review and then you can reflect and I can reflect. At the moment, you are causing hysteria.
But only hours later, it was the bombshell revelations of the existence of three internal HSE memos showing a media strategy of containment to keep women in the dark about their cancer, which finally did for HSE Chief Tony O'Brien.
You're listening to Maureen Ireland at 13 minutes past seven. The advice could not be more clear. Quote, pause all letters, await advice of solicitors, decide on the order and volume of dispatch to mitigate any potential risks, continue to prepare reactive communications response for a media headline that screening did not diagnose my cancer. These are the next steps outlined in what has been described as a devastating internal HSE memo prepared in March 2016 after it became clear that an audit of the cervical screen programme had failed to detect cancer in women who subsequently developed the disease. Within hours of the memo being released and two others, HSE Chief Executive Tony O'Brien announced he was standing down from his post.
And on the Today Show yesterday, Vicky Phelan gave her reaction to Tony O'Brien's departure and to his tweet which criticised the TDs who questioned him at the Public Accounts Committee on Thursday.
when I saw that tweet this morning, I just thought, here I am, he's after resigning and I'm still angry, because I just think, can he not go away quietly? You know, he's a public servant who is accountable for his actions. He should be allowed to be questioned. And I didn't see anything wrong with the form of questioning that Mark was asking yesterday. His tweet smacks of someone who is used to getting his own way. Throwing one's toys out of the pram springs to mind. So, you know, the issues that were being raised concern the cover-up and the lack of absolute regard for the women caught up in this scandal. And his use of the word hysteria really now just sent me over the edge, to be honest, yesterday when I heard that. I have asked for his resignation from the very beginning of this case. I'm glad it's happened now at this stage, but again, I would echo Mark's sentiments. Can somebody not take him aside and tell him this is not about him, not by a long shot. This was never about him, but he doesn't seem to realise that.
More than a fortnight on, questions remain before the crisis in confidence in the cervical check programme can be resolved.
John Downing, for you, I mean, one of the questions, I suppose a lot of the questions people are asking is who knew what and when. The memo that emerged yesterday went some way towards shedding light on that. How long do you think we'll be waiting to find out the true extent of this?
We're promised something early next month from this preliminary inquiry. And we'd hope to learn something concrete. I mean, the big danger in the middle of all this and the history, the anatomy of these kind of scandals and things is that they're parked, they're long-fingered, and they're frequently forgotten, and then they're repeated.
John Downing, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, with Richard Curran yesterday. Meanwhile, as the Cabinet announced practical measures to help the 209 women affected by the scandal, widower Stephen Teep is at the coalface, coping with the devastation that's left behind after a cancer diagnosis. Stephen's wife, Irene, died in agony from cervical cancer on the 26th of July last year. She was 35 and one of the 17 women who died without knowing she'd been given two incorrect smear test results. Stephen is now rearing their two sons alone, Oscar and Noah, who are now 5 and 3. When he spoke with Ray Darcy, he recalled their last family outing to Disneyland when Irene was very ill but determined to create memories for her children.
And even up to the day we went to Disneyland, like Irene again was in the hospital the week before. She only got out the day before, and even the morning of the flight, we were flying out from Cork, I think it might have been around 2, and even that morning, like we went to bed that night not knowing if we were going or not, and that morning Irene just goes, look, let's just do it, let's just go. So I had the terrible job of packing bags, and you know, packing bags for Irene, who's the ultimate perfectionist, is a dangerous enough job for any man to take on. I took all that on, and we went on the flight over, and yeah, I think she references in her blog, you know, that, like, you know, it was amazing. As soon as we arrived, Irene was just, I don't know, you just, there is magic over there. And, you know, she was just overwhelmed by it. Like, it was just basically this. So Irene again researches everything to the max, yeah. You know, and like, I had discovered that, you know, if you write up, could get a letter from your consultant, you can get this pass. It's like a white pass, I think, which allows you to go in all the wheelchair access, you and the family and the kids, and
preferential,
like,
treatment.
Willy Wonka in the chocolate factory. This golden ticket here, you know, if, like, what else do you want when you've got a 4 and a 2-year-old?
Yeah.
Stop every ride as you walk up to it and hop on, you know, like, that's what they do for people like are unfortunately in Irene's situation. So we hired a wheelchair, we had a sling on my back for Noah, and Oscar was sitting in Irene's lap in the wheelchair, and we were motoring around.
Here come the teeps
with our big white pass, and let us through, you know, and you're going past all the queues, or stopping the ride for you as soon as you want to get jump on. And
they're lovely memories for you
amazing.
And the lads.
It was amazing, yeah.
And Ray asked Stephen why he decided to speak out.
There's only one reason why I made this story public, and you know, I didn't want to be referred to as one of the 17 anymore. I wanted people to see that, you know, they're like, there's real people at the end of this, and there's two little boys at the end of this, and there was a loving mom that didn't want to leave at the end of this as well. I just had this kind of vision in my head, a conversation 10 years down the road with Oscar and Noah, and we're discussing, you know, what happened, mom, and you know, how did she die? And, you know, and I'm sure this audit will come up and it'll be a case of, so what did you do then, Dad? Look, there's only one answer for that question for me. I would have done what your mother would have done. And I would have fought this. And, you know, we got to make this right. And I was saying to you earlier about, you know, like, there's 209 women minus 17 that are already dead who are currently going through a cancer treatment as we speak. Some of them, I hope, have gotten the all clear on that. But some of them are like the wonderful Vicky Phelan, who actually are fighting for their lives with a terminal diagnosis. No one's talking about them now and about the actual what's it like to have this news landed on top of you last week? Because last Thursday night when we were told about these audits and the misreading of these smears, it was essentially goodbye and God bless. Get out of here now. You're done. You know, I've delivered the news. There was absolutely no support services or anything offered to us, my boys, Irene's parents who are in an awful state right now, her sisters. But to the other women that are currently facing this treatment, I remember very clearly when Irene was going through all of these treatments. It's difficult. Irene availed of counselling through charity groups in Cork, and she was doing that when there wasn't a scandal that's just what ifs written all over it and misdiagnosed.
And that's the what ifs. You must be going through that in your head.
It is. I'm trying to push it out right now because I guess I'm just overwhelmed with anger, and I'm just trying to channel this just to try and get some accountability for what's gone on. Like, clearly right now, no one has control over this situation. The government have no control over this. The HSE definitely don't.
Stephen Teep heard on the Ray D'Arcy show on Tuesday. Well, John is a father of five from Kildare. He also lost his wife to cervical cancer, and he spoke with Sean O'Rourke on Thursday.
My wife used to just look at her baby and she'd just cry sometimes. I think she was thinking, you know, I'm not going to be around. Is he going to remember me? And the thing is, he doesn't remember because he was only two when she passed. And now, on Mother's Day in school, for example, when all the kids are making Mother's Day cards, he used to make one for me. The teachers aren't trained to handle this sort of thing with younger kids, and he makes Happy Father's Day. Two cards a year come to me, you know, and he does say it to me, and it breaks my heart every time he says it. I miss my mom, Dad. Even though he doesn't remember her, I have some DVDs of happy times. I sit down and I watch them, birthdays, Christmas and Halloween. And when I got my two of my children counselling, the child counsellor suggested to me that you need to sit down with him and watch these DVDs and stuff like that. But when he gets up to walk away, just let him walk away. And that's what he does about 5 or 10 minutes into it. And he's such a happy little boy.
He'd be, what, 9 years of
age
now?
He's nine now, yeah. And I can't tell him any of this now because this has reopened, you know, all sorts of old wounds. And it's just, I feel like the HSE took a gamble with my wife's life. They didn't lose anything and we lost everything. So I do feel like tremendously sad for my children now. I feel anger and I feel I have a constant sense of feeling robbed.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. The town of Granard in County Longford has come to symbolise the dark, hidden, paternalistic Ireland of the 1980s, a place where the Catholic Church held sway. But in fact, what happened at Granard was a collective tragedy that still resonates throughout our society. Anne Lovett was only 15 when she gave birth to her baby son at a Grotto to Our Lady on the last day of January 1984. Both Anne and her baby Patrick died. Rosita Boland's extraordinary interview with Anne Lovett's boyfriend, Ricky MacDonald, in the Irish Times last Saturday, with its new revelations about an alleged attack and the burning of a letter, has yet again ignited calls for the people of Granard to break down their wall of silence, face down the rumours and innuendo, and give up the secrets of what exactly happened there 34 years ago. Former journalist Emily O'Reilly, now the European Ombudsman, broke the original story in the Sunday Tribune.
I was very moved by the story and obviously also very intrigued by it, as for 34 years very little information had come out about the circumstances around the death of Anne and of her baby. And this was the first time as well that she had been given a face, in the sense it was the first time that the public had seen a photograph of Anne. And I have to say I found that possibly the most moving part of Rosita Boland's piece.
Knowing the story as well as you do and having read that piece at the weekend, do you think that this will lead to further revelations in this case?
Well, I was talking to Rosita after the story appeared and congratulating her on the enormous journalistic effort she put into it over many months. And I said that what she had done was unpick a thread, and who knew how that thread was going to unravel. I mean, her interview with Anne's boyfriend raised an awful lot of questions as well. There are an awful lot of questions still overhanging this. But I think we have to remember that two investigations were started at the time into what happened to Anne. One was the guards. By the guards, and the other was by the late Nuala Fennell, who was then a minister, I think, in Gareth Fitzgerald's cabinet. She was a minister for women's affairs, and neither of those investigations were ever published, or I'm not even sure whether they were completed. I know that Rosita Boland went in search of them and didn't come up with anything, but the fact is that this was a child who died. Two children died. I mean, she was only 15, and she died in those appalling circumstances. The account of her boyfriend in the Irish Times talks about, you know, the involvement of the church, involvement of the guards, and I think perhaps we owe it to Anne and to her baby and to others indeed to find out the truth of what actually happened.
Niall McCafferty, it was reported in the Sunday Business Post yesterday, has made a call for the remains of Anne Lovett's baby to be exhumed for DNA testing. Would you support that?
Well, that would be a very big step, and I don't know what the circumstances would be in which that could be done. I thought it was interesting that while Ricky, her boyfriend in the Irish Times, it says, you know, revealed or, you know, an interview with Anne Lovett's boyfriend, but it doesn't say the father of her baby, and that isn't clear. I don't know how important it still would be to ascertain that, and I don't know the steps that would be taken. You know, when a story like this happens, you know, you don't know where it's going to go. You don't know where pressure is going to come from, whether just the media or whether the public at large, whether the politicians will take an interest in it as well. I think, you know, people have to reflect on it and to see what it is necessary to know in order to give the respect back to Anne and to her child and to everybody who was involved in that tragedy at the time.
Emily O'Reilly heard on the News at One with Claire Byrne on Bank Holiday Monday. On Wednesday, Drive Time reporter John Cook visited Granard. He spoke to a mass goer about her memory of the tragedy and the atmosphere in the town all those years ago.
It was a terrible, terrible tragedy, and the people of Granard were moved, shocked, terrorised almost by it, that it could happen. And we all had to come to terms with it. It was very, very difficult. And I would think about the Lovett family and their terrible difficulties.
They're a very well-respected family from what I can gather from other people this morning.
Yes, and still are indeed. It's just that I don't know, in the name of God, why it has to be brought back all the time.
People are saying there are new revelations and there could be more to come to light. Maybe that more answers would come to light as to exactly what happened. Do people in Granard want those answers, do you think?
But what happened was a mother and her young baby died. That was what happened. Answers to what?
I suppose people are coming forward with, well, suggestions that Anne wrote letters, that maybe some people helped to cover it up, or others have questions to answer.
I don't think that's part of the whole thing at all. I don't know.
It's a difficult one for people to talk about around here, and I appreciate you talking to me. A lot of people aren't comfortable doing that.
I think it's very difficult for any person to even think and talk about it, regardless if they're from Granard or any other part of the country. And I don't think that Granard is unique in that. The reality and the fact was that in terrible circumstances, a young mother and her baby died.
Do we need to know why she did that?
But these things happen. I don't understand why that question has even been asked. It could happen today, could happen tomorrow.
Up at the grotto where Anne gave birth, John spoke to two women who were very angry at the latest media intrusion and what they regarded as the raking over of old coals.
I didn't know Anne, but I was there only 4 miles out the road, and I can know that people around Granard done their level best when they found, you know, when they found her. They done their level.
Why did nobody help her if she was pregnant and people knew it?
No, they didn't know it, and she didn't want it.
Do you think people really didn't know she was full-term pregnant?
I don't know that time.
Look at here, if the child wanted to tell it, she would have told it. If she wanted help, she wanted to go alone, so she's in heaven, and due to respect for the family.
And so is the child. And then I think it only came out now because of the referenda. That's the truth.
The revelations that came out maybe would suggest there was reasons Anne couldn't seek help or deliberately didn't seek it. Maybe she was afraid, maybe something had been done wrong to her.
That's a load of bull now. That's all lies. There was nobody that wouldn't help that child. There was nobody in the world that wouldn't help that girl if she was in trouble.
Her mother was a lady
a
and her father a Lord saint in heaven.
She's a saint now. That's the truth. That's the way we feel. And it's not fair to be bringing it back like that.
Are you upset about that coming out in the papers again?
I am upset personally. I think it was only brought for the referenda. If that lady, that gal, had brought her child to full term, she had the guts to do that. And she could have handed up for adoption.
But we're standing here looking up at the grotto up
in the lady. That's our lady. That's our lady. I know, church. That gal is mentioned every time just as an excuse for other people's downfall.
But you said she was brave to go to full term with the baby.
Well, she was.
But think of it.
But hang on, she had the baby up in the rocks here in the grotto. I mean, surely that was a sign of desperation, was it?
There was no other girls done that. Had babies outside and was lucky. The mother shared them or whatever. That was happening all along. But I think Anne should be allowed rest. And her own mother and father and all belonging to her to said along her. And all the people that helped her out so well that day. They done their level best for her. She was found alive. And everyone went to her aid. Everyone.
Look at Joanna Hayes and all in Kerry. Look what they've done with them. Destroyed the family and everything else. It's ridiculous. And the media.
But the Kerry babies, there are still questions to be answered now, even all these years later. Are there questions to be answered in Granard?
No, there's not. As far as I'm concerned.
Who's going to answer them questions? People that knew was dead. The girl is dead. There was nothing wrong with Granard, only the people were afraid to come out and speak. It was different times.
They didn't know anything.
But they were afraid. They were afraid to come out because what you would make of it. What the media would make from it. They were afraid to tell them.
And do you think people are still afraid to talk then?
There's nothing to talk about.
Well, there's nothing to say because the girl is dead. Lord, and she's in heaven. And you may say that someone that's 34 years above dead in Grand Kill Cemetery. That is in heaven. Her soul, she's a saint above in heaven looking down. There, look up at the statue. That should be a shrine to St. Anne and the child.
There's no marker there for her, though, is there?
I don't know. We all have her here in our heart. There isn't a morning that I go to Mass that wouldn't say a prayer for Anne. And was.
People feel things were maybe covered up at that time, though. And
mind their own business.
Exactly.
John Cook reporting for Drive Time with Mary Wilson. I wonder what the writer and journalist Nuala O'Fuaillean would have made of all these revelations and stories about women's lives. She was a fearless chronicler of our times. And it's hard to believe it's 10 years since her death from cancer. You'll remember shortly after her diagnosis, she gave an extraordinary interview to her close friend Marion Finucane, an interview which displayed a candour that was as heartbreaking as it was brave.
Even if I gained time through the chemotherapy, it isn't time I want, because as soon as I knew that I was going to die soon, the goodness went out of life. It amazed me, Marion, how quickly life turned black, immediately almost. For example, I live somewhere beautiful, but it means nothing to me anymore, the beauty. And I'm not nice or anything. I'm not getting nicer. I'm sour and difficult, you know. I don't know how my friends and family are putting up with me, though they are heroically, and that is one of the things you learn.
To mark the 10th anniversary of her death, a commemorative edition of Nuala's best-selling memoir, Are You Somebody?, is being reissued by New Ireland. And Marion was joined in studio by Tony Glavin, who commissioned and edited the book, by her friend, Luke Dodd, and by her sister, Deirdre Brady, all of whom miss her terribly. Deirdre recalled the reaction from the family when the book was first published.
Some were embarrassed, some were angry, some were proud of her. But overall, in the end, we all loved her.
You didn't like her talking about your father's death?
No, I didn't.
And what did she say to you when you challenged her on that?
She didn't take my advice. No, she never took my advice, actually. She was always giving me advice. Very rarely did I go against her, I must say.
Right, okay.
But when I did, wow.
You were also taken aback at the amount of lovers she had.
Oh, I was, yeah. And I remember on the Late Late, I think Gay said it to her, and I said as well, and she said, that's only half of them or something. But you see, I think it's like, as Luke said, passion meant so much around physical. Passion obviously did too.
Well, I mean, she used to talk at great length about how much your mother loved your father and that she brightened up and lightened up when he came around, even though he hurt her by being so unfaithful.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You got her ready, so to speak, Luke, for that Late Late Show interview.
Yeah, I remember she'd got a new
sort of outfit, and she was sitting down waiting for the car to come or whatever, and she went, "Oh, Jesus, look!" And the sort of front of her jacket was gaping, you know, when she sat down, so we had to sew her into it. And then, you know, it was one of those curious things where she headed off and then I turned on the telly and she was on with Gay Byrne, and then she came straight back as well. I think she had a real inkling what was about to happen, certainly in Ireland, but that was it. She sort of had to head home immediately to have a quiet glass of wine once it was over.
Yeah, because he took her up on the lovers too.
I really enjoy that because Nuala admired Gay Byrne a great deal, and he was a friend of your father's, Deirdre, I think. And but he came at her twice. I always remember it, you know, about the lovers. And, you know, Nuala batted him off the first time with humour, saying, you know, basically that I only ever really loved three men. Yeah. And sure, I just had, you know, sometimes I just had sex for the exercise. But Gay, with that prurient nose he has, came back again. And she then did that thing that I knew Nuala so well for. She looked at him and she just said, "Maybe people like me were the way we were so that people like you could feel respectable."
Oh, wow. Gosh. Great memory.
And that was, you know, don't come back unless you want. So he backed off.
From the Marion Finucane show last Saturday. Singer Ryan O'Shaughnessy laid waste to the naysayers by powering through to the final of Eurovision in Lisbon in a nail-biting contest last Tuesday, Ireland's first appearance in the final in 5 years. And Ryan also hit the headlines when China censored his dancer's performance and then lost the rights to broadcast the final.
We were drifting like two icebergs out on the ocean. I was doing all I could to keep you close. There were troubles in the water, you swore it was nothing. You said that we would always stay afloat. Why would true love look me in the eye and lie? I thought we'd be
together, sung by Ryan O'Shaughnessy. Well, Ryan was channeling his inner Conor McGregor when he spoke with Ray Darcy.
I think those 15 minutes of the voting was probably the toughest. You know, the last thing you want to do is when you're representing your country is to come back without having a bit of success. So I think we were all happy now that we're through to the grand final.
Yeah.
And it hasn't happened in a few years. So
you say that we're going to win it now on Saturday night. Fight and talk.
You know what, I think you just have to be positive about it. And if McGregor ever taught us anything, I know he probably hasn't got great press in the last couple of months, whatever, but if he taught us anything, it's the power of positivity.
Yeah.
That's kind of, that's the train of thought now at the moment, and we're focusing now onto Saturday, and we're going to just up the ante and bring an even better performance. So I think we can do it. I do think we can. We did it 7 times already.
Yeah.
So if any country can do it, we can do it.
So all roads lead to Lisbon tonight. But what's the competition like? RTE's uber Eurovision fans, Spíseach Zelinski and Neil Doherty, will be commentating live on 2FM from 8 o'clock, and they gave their expert take on the ones to watch when they spoke with Ray.
I was watching it last night and I was thinking, apples and oranges, that's what came into my head.
Okay. Well, it usually is the case with Eurovision.
It is,
you know?
but like...
a few lemons thrown in.
So this one here, Israel, is the favourite to win, is it?
Not anymore.
No.
Cyprus is the favourite to win, but it has been the favourite for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Let's have a listen. What age is she?
She would be 25,
right.
In her early 20s anyway.
Yeah.
But she is a very accomplished performer in Israel, and she has sung with everybody and at every single TV show and so on.
And the Cyprus one, that was the last song last night.
Yeah, this was the one that came on after Ryan O'Shaughnessy. So Fuego, it translates as fire. So they're calling her the Cypriot Beyonce. They're saying that she's actually taken a lot of Beyonce's moves, which I think a lot of people agree with. And this is the one that flipped in the last 24 hours. So everyone was talking about Israel until yesterday. Suddenly it flipped and it was like, this woman, Cyprus, Elena.
Cause I'm
Fuego yourself.
Fuego.
I think she's Eurovision. She's Beyonce light. Does that matter in Eurovision?
I don't think so.
It doesn't matter.
I mean, I see the comparisons of with Beyonce, like the big hair, the hip movements and so on. But the staging is on point. I mean, like out of the whole competition, I would say that this is the best realized staging. And they spend a lot of money on it. The person who's behind the staging is called Sasha Jean-Baptiste. She's Swedish and she is like a staging supremo. She's actually working with a couple of acts this year. But this is her best staging of this year.
Okay, Norway, Alexander is back with his fiddle.
Yeah, so 9 years later, he's back with a song called That's How You Write a Song. Fiddle on stage, loads of dancers, loads of energy.
This is it. Just roll with it, that's how you write a song. He still has to get out of the second semi-final, doesn't he?
Yeah, so semi-final two takes place on Thursday, but he's tipped to win semi-final two.
Okay. And Sweden, they're on six, are they? And if they win this year, they're equal to us,
oh,
seven
yes.
wins.
That's... I don't think they're going to win this year. They're in the second semi-final on Thursday. This is Benjamin Ingrosso with Dance You Off. Just wanna dance you off.
So don't you dare wait up. Immediately forgettable. Australia, which is the greatest.
It's one of our favourites, actually, Australia.
Oh, Jessica Mowboy. Yeah, this song is so cool. It's really poppy. She's amazing. But Spíšek knows, apparently there were tears in one of the rehearsals. She just can't carry it off live.
Yeah, I think she suffers from a little bit of a stage fright. I know what you must be thinking.
And you can tune in to Neil Doherty and Spíšek Zelinski tonight on RTE2FM for all the Eurovision action at 8 o'clock. And of course, best of luck to Ryan O'Shaughnessy and his dancers. And we mustn't forget the Leinster team, who face Racing in Bilbao this evening. Well, while the cervical check scandal dominated the airwaves this week, there were other stories making the headlines. On The Gathering yesterday, Richard Curran was joined by journalists Susan Daly and John Downing and TDs Breege Smith and Kate O'Connell.
Another interesting story, which was a very hot political topic, was Shane Ross's proposal and plan around rural transport and the so-called Drinklink bus. Kate O'Connell, a lot of people in rural Ireland saying it, very, very unhappy with it, saying it's piecemeal and it's tokenistic.
Well, it's a pilot. It's designed to connect people in rural communities with urban centres if they have no transport. I don't see what could be possibly wrong with it. It's a six-month pilot. The view is that it will be rolled out further after that if people engage with it. And you can see that the people, the usual suspects, Diana Healy Ray given out about it, and yet, you know, all for rural transport a few months ago. So, you know, it would be ideal if we had a bus going from every boreen everywhere to an urban centre every 20 minutes, but that's not practical. But and what we're doing here is we're starting a pilot and we're hoping to expand on it.
John Downing, do you think this can help cure rural loneliness and isolation?
I think it can. I think it's to be welcomed. I think in fairness to Brendan Griffin, I watched him getting a terrible battering. He was talking to me about this several years ago, and he's persisted with it, and other people like Martin Hayden in the Fine Gael party have tried and overcome opposition. Do it. It is small. It's very easy to dismiss it as tokenism. It's very easy to criticise it in all sorts of ways. Let's hope it's just a start to try and give rural Ireland something comparable pro rata in terms of population, in terms of public transport services. This one sits on the two major fault lines which are interlinked. One is town versus country. The other is the interlinked question of how we deter drink driving across the country, which remains a problem.
From the Today Show with Richard Curran yesterday. Well, whatever about the drink, a love of baking may seem like a handy way to show appreciation for colleagues through the regular production of delicious treats for the office at large. But as Colette Sexton of the Sunday Business Post explained to Richard Curran, baker, beware.
One batch of brownies too many and you might become the office mammy. And no one wants to be the office mammy.
Indeed they don't, because according to Colette, brownies can lead to other less desirable tasks being lumped onto the brownie maker.
you need to think about it in this way. There are different kinds of work assignments and not all assignments are equal. So there are the glamour assignments, which are like the, you know, working on the biggest client, working on the biggest deal the company's ever had. And then there's the more tedious stuff that no one really wants to do, but it has to get done. And we call that office housework. So there are kind of three main types of office housework.
What kind of things, yeah, would be in office housework?
So, And these happen outside of the spotlight, we'll say. So first of all, there's admin. So it's the taking of notes, the booking the conference room, getting everyone on the line for the call, planning parties, buying gifts when someone is leaving, serving on committees that aren't linked to revenue. Okay, and then there's also the emotional labour. So, oh no, you know, Pat's over there and he's in bad form. Would you go over and talk to him? I think he had a row or something like that.
So what then should a woman do? When asked maybe to do one of these things, you're saying don't rush in to volunteer because you're going to get stereotyped, you're going to get labelled, you're going to do all of these things and it could actually affect your career and your progress. What should you do if you're asked?
Okay, you need to think, there's probably people sitting at home right now saying, but I love baking for the office. And that's fair enough. But if you do end up picking up all of these other roles, like look around, is anyone else baking for the office or is it just you? And then are you suddenly the one who has to buy the card and pass it around when someone's retiring? And it might take 10 minutes of your day, but that adds up to hours and hours every year. And they're hours that you should be spending on your actual job.
What if you enjoy doing it? Your job is pretty boring and mundane and actually creating that collegiality in the office and getting on well with your colleagues in that sort of way is actually what makes the job bearable and tolerable.
Well, fair enough if that is how you feel, but just think about, do you want to progress? Do you want to be in the less mundane job? Do you want to be working with the client that's super exciting that everyone wants to work with? In that case, should you be spending that time in a better way, maybe trying to progress your own career, looking at what your boss values and other people that have been promoted and how you can copy what they have done?
So the message is, bake not, lest you be judged. From The Business with Richard Curran. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for Richard. He'll be here shortly after the 10 o'clock news with The Business. But I'll leave you now with a song from Bjoga, who played live on The Ray Darcy Show and who've been making waves on the Ed Sheeran tour around the country. Gurmag of for Goluther, Gideon Chachtan Chahogin, Gideship Slan.
If there's anything that I could truly say, it's to open up our hearts to one another. I don't mean to tell you